This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to L&G Talks Asset Management. This week, I'm joined by Colin Reedy and Jason Shoup, co-heads of Global Fixed Income at L&G. And they will be talking about our global approach to actively managing fixed income assets. And this is a fittingly international conversation as we have Colin speaking from London and Jason in Chicago. Hello to you both and thank you for your time.
Hi there.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
I think we can all appreciate the importance of being global in today's interconnected markets, especially when economic and political developments in one region can have a significant impact around the world. So let's dive in. First question to you, Colin. What does a global approach to active fixed income mean? And how does it work in practice for L&G's global active fixed income team?
It means really, simply put, ensuring that both your resources and your investment process are designed in a way that allows you to maximize the full opportunity set that your asset class offers you. If you can do that from top to bottom and from bottom to top, then you can properly move the performance dial if all areas of your operation are firing on all cylinders. Our global credit capability is run out of our GBS or Global Bond Strategies team here in London. They are effectively running strategies against credit benchmarks as well as global unconstrained mandates as well. But the structure is to all intents and purposes the same. They take responsibility for an acute focus on their asset allocation call, the overall risk management of the entire portfolio, including interest rate risk and duration risk. And that's on a sort of full look-through basis. And then the asset allocate to our subject matter experts, to Jason's team in Chicago, for example. There would be a large allocation for USIG in particular. They will be allocating to our pan-European credit teams across both euros and sterling, as well as in emerging market debt and global high yield. And that means that you are giving the money to the subject matter experts, the people who really know their market inside out and backside forwards. It's far, far better for us to get Jason's team to be going into the weeds and into real detail on individual stocks and sectors in the US investment grade market than it is for us to be doing it from London. So we trust them with that allocation.
So what is unique about our global approach?
Unique is a dangerous word because we don't have line of sight of what everyone else is doing. But I think what I would call out is a genuinely, unashamedly team-based approach and the culture that sort of fosters on a sort of day-to-day basis. We believe teams are the right way to go because markets, as I'm sure we'll come on to talk about, are so complex today. There are so many moving factors and other areas sort of influencing what's going on a day-to-day basis that it's simply beyond the capabilities of the individual investment expert. A good team will always deliver a better outcome, we think, in today's markets. And the second point, I think, why it makes us better is just having that diversity of debate and input and different views from different parts of the world, different perspectives on all these sort of different moving parts, I think enriches our debate and allows us to really drive that idea generation engine as hard as we can, because the whole team is effectively in service of getting as many good ideas into portfolios as possible. And I think, you know, the Chicago team was launched in 2006. So, you know, we have long experience of navigating tough and challenging cycles since the team was set up. And, you know, I think the strong relationships that we've built are forged on sort of shared values. It's not identical opinions. It's not important that we agree, but it's really important that we disagree well. And I think a lot of the debate in the investment process that we have regularly focuses on drawing out those disagreements and making sure that we get to good decisions.
You mentioned the importance of trusting those regional experts on the ground. How do you balance the regional specific expertise and regional specific issues with a need for a globally consistent approach?
Well, there's two ways. One of the things that you have to manage in the overlay is that if we are allocating, let's say, 50% of the global credit portfolio to Jason and the team, and they're benchmarked against a US investment grade benchmark, they're running a fully diversified portfolio against that benchmark. That means that we're at the aggregate portfolio level, we're only getting sort of 50% of their best ideas. So for the really high conviction views that the team has and the research analysts have, you know, we need to make sure that they're properly moving the dial at the overall portfolio level. So one of the responsibilities for the overlay, in addition to risk management and the other areas that I mentioned, was to make sure that those good ideas, those high conviction views, are dialed up in the overlay to make sure that we've got sufficient risk attached to a position that we have high conviction in, to make sure that when it comes right, it's actually delivering the alpha that we would expect it to. Away from that, there is a balancing element, as you say. We work in increasingly global markets. There will be the same issuers in the US market as there will be, you know, there'll be some overlap with the European market. We need to be quite vigilant to make sure that we're not doubling up on risks and on an unintended basis. So if there's, you know, strong views regarding an issuer in the Euro portfolio, that's a balance with what's taking place in the US portfolio. And that full look through risk management sort of system, you know, allows us to make sure that we are as balanced as we can be across the piece. So amplifying in the right areas and also dialing down risk in other areas where we're maybe worried around concentration. You talked about macro events in one region possibly influencing how we do things in other areas. It's rare that a strong isolated event doesn't influence markets in aggregate. A genuinely isolated one is unusual, but that's why you have your experts. They're closer to the coalface. They will understand and be able to analyze that situation far better than we will from London. So again, one of the benefits of the sort of hub and spoke approach to global credit.
So Jason, moving on to you, I wanted to ask about the global meetings that you have across the team, and also wanted to hear an example of how takeaways from those global meetings have fed into your regional positioning.
One of the unique things that we do is really truly have a joined up process where we meet regularly between the teams, regardless of the geographies that they're in, and really discuss the outlook, discuss the markets. And I'll talk a little bit about that. I think when you hear the idea of a global meeting, you sort of think there's some formal process, Robert's rules of order, you know, a team of experts maybe forecasting the whole world and where the economy is going. And that's not really what our global meetings kind of feel like and how we conduct them, except for the team of experts, definitely a team of experts there. I'd say it's a far more humble conversation, very, you know, built out of what we see going on in markets, and a lot of, as Colin mentioned, a lot of positive challenge around the table to really kick the tires on our views, our biases, you know, ways in which we may be viewing markets that are simply a product of the region that we're operating in and the news that we're consuming. I don't think we always get to a definitive answer in those types of meetings. But I do think one of the big objectives always is to really understand the narratives that are driving markets, and then to understand how those narratives might be vulnerable. So earlier this year, there was definitely a lot of angst around tariffs in the U.S. Maybe there still is angst around tariffs in the U.S. Things like U.S. exceptionalism were definitely a prevailing theme of 2024 and started to come into question, or at least be challenged in 2025. And I think there was a lot of asking earlier in the first half of whether or not we might see sort of global flows directed away from the U.S. going forward, right? And we can have that debate. We can certainly share our views globally. But isn't it nice to have teams that are operating in all of these regions that can actually take the temperature of whether or not they're seeing, you know, flows being redirected away from the United States? And what was the answer? We're still in early days yet. But what we saw was a little bit of interest in Euro credit, but nothing that would necessarily disrupt credit markets in a wholesale way in the U.S. And being able to get that information from our globally, you know, aligned team really, you know, provides a little bit of value and edge, even if it's only, you know, maybe 1 month before others kind of catch on to the same sort of conclusion.
Clearly a really valuable process there. We were teased a little bit about the idea of debating. So, Jason, I'd love you to tell me about one of your debates and what was the outcome.
Yeah, I think, you know, a debate that we've been having that's, you know, really live right now, right, is kind of on the labor market in the U.S. and what seems to be going on there. And there are a lot of different perspectives. It does strike us that if you think about the weakening that we've seen in hiring that's happened in the U.S. apparently over the course of the year, this point where we've gotten to, you know, with the latest data, less than 30,000 jobs being hired in the U.S., which is one of the lowest levels that we've seen in a long time, a June print that was actually negative, right? So we, you know, had layoffs for the first time on that month. That if you had known that a year ago, surely you would have thought that with tariffs and with the labor market doing what it now seems to be doing, that risk assets would be far more discounting of negative news, you know, ahead, right? Instead, we have, you know, stocks at the highs, we have credit spreads at some of the lowest levels that we've seen in 30 years. And so the debate was really around, how is that possible? How is it you can actually see kind of a deterioration in the data that you maybe were worried would happen and get almost, you know, no reaction in the market that you thought would be most sensitive to it? And I think part of the answer that really came out in our discussions was that sometimes psychology matters. Sometimes the manner in which the message is delivered to you matters a lot. And the answer is, for us at least, that the labor market deterioration that you've seen in the U.S. hasn't been experienced in real time, if that makes any sense. It's really come about all through revisions and sort of, you know, archaic revisions sometimes at that, right? So, you know, adjusting of the BLS's birth, death, company formation model downward. So, you know, you learn 6 months after the fact that the hires that were done a year ago are actually less than you thought. Or that negative print that you saw in the June data, actually you didn't get it in June. You only saw it come September with the regular 3 month revisions. And so there's something about and really, you know, something that was debated hotly was really this notion that, well, if you reveal the data in such a manner that it's not experienced so viscerally at the minute, you can really get away with maybe delivering a much more negative backdrop of data without actually disrupting markets nearly as much as you might think.
So we've built up quite a strong understanding of our global approach in practice. So let's switch gears now to talk about your views on current dynamics and fixed income markets that are most pressing to investors around the world. So what are some examples of key issues that you've discussed at your most recent meeting?
So I think one of the hottest debates as we finish the remainder of the year here that we're having in our strategy meetings is really about the Fed. We all know that the Fed has come under a reasonable amount of scrutiny or attention that goes beyond just whether or not it will deliver another cut in the coming months to come, but also really about the ultimate control of the Fed, the governors, and who might be running the Fed come next year, and whether or not they can deliver the types of outcomes that the president clearly wants. And when we think about the Fed, and really the debate that we've been having has been, if the Fed continues to deliver 25 basis point cuts over the balance of the year, markets seem relatively well priced for those outcomes. But you do see a number of investors questioning and asking whether or not the Fed should go faster than that, almost catch up for the long period of pause. And the trickiness to that, to trying to understand what the Fed should do next, really comes from the fact that usually when we talk about the Fed, we're talking about sort of a reaction function that is the same reaction function between meetings. And we're now having to really contemplate this idea that it could be that the reaction function of the Fed is also changing. So whether or not the Fed delivers a near-term 50 basis point cut versus a 50 basis point cut or a faster pace of cuts in a few months' time could have really different implications, right, in terms of how we think about the economy and how they're responding to the economy. And I think the final thing I would say is, what could the Fed do before the end of the year that might be more supportive of markets? And that's something we're always trying to ask ourselves and really think about challenging ourselves in terms of, you know, things that might happen that we're maybe not fixating on. And the one thing that comes to mind that hasn't really gotten much discussion is the balance sheet. Earlier this year in March, the Fed slowed down the pace of quantitative tightening. They reduced the caps on the Treasury runoff. But we're coming, after 6 months now, we're coming back to a point where reserves have started to decline. We're starting to see, you know, the first signs of maybe tighter liquidity conditions. And it wouldn't be crazy for the Fed to really start to think about what more it could do on the balance sheet, maybe fully ending the runoff and the shrinking of the balance sheet, maybe even buying treasuries and letting mortgages continue to run off. Both of those as potential, you know, kind of wild cards into year end in terms of what the Fed could do could be really positively greeted by markets and maybe even more so than a 50 basis point cut would be.
So fiscal largesse and waning demand for long-term debt are not merely US problems. There are also difficulties faced by other developed market countries as well. So what does this mean for fixed income markets globally?
This is one of the key themes that's actually been with us since the pandemic. We've been pretty consistent in our view that the pandemic was the catalyst for a seismic shift from monetary to fiscal policy, and that if that was maintained, it would end the sort of secular stagnation environment that sat behind a 30-year bull market in fixed income. Ever since then, we've seen an increasing body of evidence that would suggest that administrations, particularly Western administrations, are using fiscal policy as the primary economic growth stimulant for their economies, and monetary policy is now very much the brakes. So hugely different environment for central banks than it was before. Now, obviously, that has come with materially higher deficits to the point that now fiscal sustainability is a live issue in fixed income markets. And, you know, you mentioned that it's not merely US problems. Well, I mean, here in the UK, obviously, the gilt market was really punished back in October 22 as a result of ill-advised and badly timed fiscal expansion by the then government. However, I think the real elephant in the room here is that it's one thing punishing the little old gilt market. It's something very, very different when you're talking about the US Treasury market, because that is the global sort of risk-free rate of return. And it kind of underpins everything. These are big, slow-moving themes, but they really are significant, because if you don't trust the meaning of risk-free, can you really trust the meaning of risk? I mean, we've built everything in financial markets on our understanding of what is risk-free and what is risk. All our economic, you know, models, our inflation models, banking insurance models, regulatory models, I mean, they're all pretty compromised if you're starting to question the meaning of risk-free in US sovereign debt. Now, I don't think these issues are they're in the background, shall we say, and growing in significance. And it's a hugely different environment for fixed income investors to what most have experienced throughout their career pre-pandemic. So we continue to believe that there are big pieces of the jigsaw puzzle moving around here, and it's really ensuring that our debate is as forward-looking as possible, you know, because the early identification of these key themes is what will drive performance, and it does need to be early, because by the time the consensus latches onto this, it's too late. You'll have missed your opportunity.
Jason, you've described enduring investor confidence in the face of mounting contradictions. So what could cause confidence to really crack?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke a little bit about the labor market and the kind of manner in which it's revealed itself. And how that's allowed investor confidence essentially to stay relatively high, right? As sort of evidenced by where stock market valuations are, where credit spreads, you know, how narrow they have become versus the Treasury market or the govy market. So, you know, one way that you could think about that unraveling is if you were to experience a little bit more weakness in real time, right? Which is what I was touching on before. There's a lot of investor belief that what we're going to see is sort of a downshifting and hiring and a stabilization at these lower levels, and that there isn't much momentum further to move into kind of a retrenchment of hiring position. You know, maybe said differently, firms have stopped hiring in the US, but they don't seem to be moving to layoffs. And from that perspective, I think investors really believe in that view. If you were to see a, you know, minus 50,000 payroll print in real time, would that shake confidence and start to create some cracks? I think possibly yes, particularly given where valuations are. It's not like valuations are giving you a lot of compensation for any sort of change in the prevailing narrative to really, you know, exert itself. The other one that, you know, we'd be remiss with having a podcast and not mentioning is AI, right? And when you think about the U.S. economy and maybe the global economy going forward, in some sense, you know, without talking about AI, you'd be quite concerned that potential growth and the engines of economic growth in the U.S. are starting to putter out, right? That you're not doing it through expansion of the labor force. You're not doing it through the housing market, which is, you know, at the minute, actually quite weak in the U.S. or weakening in the U.S. What we have really is, you know, potentially an answer and a big productivity boom to come. And that's reflected in a lot of the valuations of the providers of AI, the deliverers of AI, right? The hyperscalers, the infrastructure companies. But I think it's fair to say that the real payoff to AI will be in the deployers, not necessarily the sellers, right? It's if corporate America, corporate, you know, everywhere, globally, the industrial space can really benefit and translate AI into significant value going forward, right? And the answer to that question is huge. If you're worried about, you know, debt sustainability issues in the developed market and in the U.S. in particular, being able to generate growth of, 2.5-3% versus 1.5-2% makes a world of difference to whether or not you're going to be able to cope with the debt loads that you have, right? The converse is true too. If we are overly enthusiastic around, you know, where AI can go and what it can deliver to the economy, and some of this proves wanting, then that too is exactly the type of event as it comes to pass that could cause confidence to crack, right? And I do think one of the interesting questions for the outlook for next year is, can you get a U.S. recession without a change in the view for AI? Right? Can you really experience a big downturn unless people also start to question the benefits of AI? And I'm not sure. I'm not sure the two are now separable from each other. And similarly, I'm not sure whether the sustainability of the U.S. fiscal situation can be unentangled now from AI. Now, at the end of the day, I'd rather have and be talking about artificial intelligence and the benefits that it can provide a society than not talking about it, right? There definitely is a lot of legitimate excitement there.
With all that in mind, how are you preparing portfolios in response?
I think it's really hard, actually, to do. In one sense, you know, at a very high level, given just where valuations are and still how much, you know, questions I think you can ask about how the narratives can challenged or weaken that are really driving valuations to these levels, it's hard for us to look each other in the eye and convince ourselves that we should really be structurally long the market or structurally overweight the market and not taking a little bit of a cautious position in terms of how we're, you know, expressing risk in our portfolios right now, right? And it may be the case that you're not necessarily looking for a significant sell-off in credit markets, for instance, or fixed income markets, and that we'll want to be more nimble than that. But valuations look very full right now. So the simplest and easiest way is just to make sure that you don't get yourself over your skis, right? You don't get yourself a little bit too deep into owning risk when valuations are, frankly, at the lowest level in terms of spread in the last 25 years, right? So I guess that's the first thing. The second thing is that, you know, oftentimes, and I said it's hard, it really is hard. Oftentimes, you want to preserve some liquidity in your portfolio and find opportunities that are a little bit riskier that you can barbell around so that you create, you know, convexity in how your portfolio behaves and that you can preserve liquidity and use that liquidity at a later time by having kind of a little bit more of a dynamic portfolio that can weather volatility and benefit from it. But there's also a precious lack of things to barbell, right? That we've seen a lot of, you know, higher spread, you know, credit opportunities either play out in a good way or move in another way in a less good way. And really the opportunity set to barbell has gotten lower too in this environment as well. So very, very difficult from that perspective. I think the looking forward, the story changes quite a bit potentially, right? And some of this is just wrapped up in the AI conversation as well. I think fixed income markets are about to get really exciting and interesting over the next year to 2 years. If we continue to really develop the AI theme across the globe and in the US, there is a significant financing requirement that is going to be needed in order to fulfill the CapEx and the expansion plans that we're expecting to see. And it's not small. It is, we're talking in the trillions of dollars over the coming few years ahead of us. It won't all be in the markets that maybe we're most accustomed to seeing finance income. So there'll definitely be issuance into markets like the investment grade market, both in the US and the UK and in Europe. But we could also see a lot of issuance in securitized markets. And the theme this year has been deals that you thought were coming into the public markets ending up in the private markets, right? And so the big question is how much really will get financed? And on the back of that, what sort of opportunities might it create across all of fixed income and dislocations that can really be capitalized on and turned into performance and value for clients?
There's a lot of historical comparisons going on at the moment between this AI theme and its expected return on investment and the late 90s sort of dot-com bubble, which I'm afraid to say I was old enough to remember. And in the late 90s, you know, the TMT companies, you know, this was really exciting, you know, generationally significant stuff. And they invested massively in cables. And cables were and are still useful to this day. But the market expected the returns on those cable investments would be sky high. And they weren't. They were vanilla. And it was that moment of reckoning that popped that bubble that then delivered the recession in 2001, 2002, which was statistically shallow, the economists will tell you now, but it was brutal in credit markets because they had financed a lot of this stuff at exactly the wrong stage of the cycle. Just picking up on one of the things that sort of Jason was saying about, you know, spreads being full, and he and I both know that one of the more traditional, reliable early warning signals is when you start hearing this time is different. And going back to the point about fiscal sustainability and the upward pressure on government yields from all the issuance they're having to do to fund these deficits, and the fact that government balance sheets look horrible, whereas most corporate balance sheets actually look in relatively good health. Therefore, you know, spreads could go materially tighter in Europe, in France in particular at the moment, who are probably in the market's crosshairs as a country more than anywhere at the moment from a fiscal sustainability. But there are some corporate bond yields that are lower than the French sovereign. And people are using that as an example that, you know, things could get really ridiculous in that environment. So there are some cycle warning signals that are starting to appear, which I think play very much to Jason's point that the next few years could be a really, really interesting time for not just fixed income markets, but markets in general.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for this week. A special thanks to Jason and Colin for sharing their insights and to our listeners for tuning in.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic, or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information. Not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.